listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As Washington continues to reel under allegations of dissension and disunity within the White House, a potential confrontation between the U.S. and Russian militaries may be on the horizon in Syria. For more on that, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, international affairs analyst at Moscow State University. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Friday. Well, Mark, we've had all this craziness with in Washington, just continuing, of course, the backdrop of Russiagate and people, the book from Robert Woodward, who, you know, I brought down one president 40 years ago, watch me do it again, his new book, Fear, and then that being disavowed by the White House, and then almost to prove it, an anonymous editorial in the New York Times, and some pushback from that. All kinds of craziness framing what we heard on Thursday, a rumor, which we can only imagine if it's true or not, that Trump intends to reverse his position again on Syria and leave some soldiers in there permanently. You know, there's a permanent U.S. presence in Syria. And then some pushback from Russia essentially saying, look, we're going in there to clean that stuff out. We know you got guys in there. You know you got guys in there. Get them out or it's going to be messy. That's all the framework for what's about to happen in Syria.
Yeah, I mean, I'm almost at a loss to say whether things are crazier in Washington, you know, in the White House right now, and you know, or in Syria. But it seems to be crazy in both places. This book of Woodward's, you know, I just have to, you know, I've already. We've seen it for the last few years, if you're, you know, familiar with the work that Bob Woodward has done recently. But, you know, you really have to ask what has happened to Bob Woodward and when did he become such a partisan and figure and such a apologist, you know, for the deep state, as it were. There is a number of quotes from Woodward's book, Fear, that feature supposedly prominent figures in the administration, and these are named quotes, having said things that are insulting to the president. You know, supposedly Mattis saying that he acts and has the understanding of a 5 to 6 year old. Similar quotes from Coates and Kelly and so on, all senior security related officials in the Trump administration. Now, none of these things are things that you or I haven't said about Trump.
Right, from what we see through the prism of the media, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, well, I mean, I don't think I have to say through the prism of the media. I'd have to say I honestly believe those things. I don't disagree with them at all. The thing is that these supposed quotes all come via second or third hand sources.
Right.
Someone said that someone said that Mattis said.
Right.
And Woodward did not go to the figures. To confirm these sources and say, did you say that?
Which is what a journalist does.
That is journalism, right? That is actual journalism.
You know, you go back to looking at one of the, you know, heroicized, versions of Woodward and Bernstein in Watergate, All the President's Men, you know, that kind of stuff. You see the actual battle, the fictionalized version of the actual battle between these guys, Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman, wanting to say things, you know, about what this one said and that one said, because, you know, Deep Throat was their anonymous source. The editor going bananas, you need two or three people on the record confirmations before I let you print that. And this is an entirely different standard now.
It is an entirely different standard. And why? Because it seats a political agenda.
Right.
Is it news that someone said these within the administration? We all have these opinions of Trump, and right. I personally don't have any doubt that Mattis and Coates and Kelly have some unpositive things, and that regularly people working not just with Trump but with any president have occasionally said negative things about them.
Right. Think about the last few presidents, for example. You can imagine what it would be like working for Obama as a serious foreign policy person, or for Bush just as a sane person, or for Clinton as somebody that knows how to keep their pants on.
Every one of the named sources in these books, at least the ones that I've just mentioned, and then I know there are others, have denied that they said these things since the book came out.
Right.
So, you know, do I believe that they might have said them? Maybe they did. Maybe the context was different. Maybe the wording was slightly different.
Right.
Maybe they didn't say them at all. We don't know. Right. And Woodward doesn't tell us because Bob Woodward wasn't doing journalism here. Chris Hedges did, some comments for this on RT, you know, Putin's propaganda network that I often weekly contribute to as well.
And I occasionally contribute to as well. Yes,
yeah. So,
still waiting for my check from Putin, by the way.
Me as well. anyway, so, you know, Chris Hedges, former New York Times journalist until he couldn't take anymore. He said of this, and I agree with him completely, that this isn't journalism.
Right.
This is court gossip.
Right.
This is what happens in every presidential administration, and for partisan purposes, right? And to be fair, God knows I have enough criticisms of the Trump administration. Trump as a person had before he took office, and so on. And we've talked about our complicated feelings about it many times. But I agree with Chris Hedges. This isn't journalism. This is the writing of court gossip to once again make yourself relevant, make your political. Does this change the relations, you know, between the country in Trump? Is this going to lead to, is this some riveting new information? No, this is court gossip.
Right.
That's all it is. It's not worthy of journalism. It is not worthy of the legacy, and you know, and at times rightly so, the mythological legacy of Bob Woodward.
Right.
And it's really a shame to see this story journalist reduced to something that we would expect now from BuzzFeed or Vox
or the National Enquirer. I mean, you asked the question, is this news?
Or Fox News on the other side, right?
Right. You know, but you asked, is this news? Okay, and that somebody said this, and actually, we're not talking about somebody said this. Is this news that somebody said that somebody said that somebody said that? And it's not even that. Is this news that somebody wrote about somebody saying somebody saying somebody said it? That's where we are.
Now,
it's insane.
What is interesting about what Woodward wrote, and that leads us into what I think is the far more important piece, is this Washington Post anonymous op-ed by someone who claims to be a senior official within the White House.
Yeah, it was the New York Times, but yeah.
The New York Times, you're right. The New York Times, yeah, the New York Times op-ed page, claiming that I am...
part of the resistance inside the Trump administration.
Part of the administration's inside the Trump administration, right? And this is just amazing. Now, to be fair, when you count what is considered a senior official within the executive branch, you're actually, depending on what tier you're talking some 640 to 1,920 different people who could possibly deserve that title. So it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be Pence. Sorry, Lodestar theorists or you know, Ivanka Trump or Mattis himself or
whoever.
Something like that. But Bob Woodward's book brings this up, and it's mentioned again in this anonymous piece that Mattis was swiping documents, abrogating U.S. Free trade agreements with Korea off the president's desk that he had ordered to prevent him from signing them.
You know, now, go ahead, because I want to frame that with
something.
That
is a coup.
Yeah,
that is a soft coup.
Not even soft.
Ineffective.
Yeah, soft, right? I mean, they just executed it. That's, you know.
Now, we have said this many times, that Trump is not in control of his own foreign and military policy.
Right.
That this cabal of generals and others around him, you know, Mattis, Coates, Kelly, the quote, adults in the room that we should be thankful are protecting us, you know, and that's fine. I mean, Trump was elected by the American people, not by Putin. Sorry. You know, it didn't happen that way.
Right.
And either you call into question our democracy, which I do on a routine basis,
because
I don't believe in it, you know, or you are perfectly okay with the idea that, you know, the deep state it's rather hilarious here. The supposed author of this goes on to say, oh, this isn't the deep state.
Right.
You know, this is the steady state.
We're just the guys in charge. We're not the deep state.
Yeah. I'm basically saying, well, this is the deep state. I mean,
right. I know. Yep. You're right. You're right. Right? Yep.
It's absolutely insane. And the fact that this isn't causing a more, you know, if you disagreed with the president's policies and you stood up an argument and you failed to convince him, and the policy went forward, and you believed it was a genuine threat to the country's national security, then your job is to refuse to perform it and to step down.
And if you want, I mean, if you want to bring political pressure, you've got an open mic at any news station on the planet. The media will gladly join you in dogging Trump over this.
They would be pushing each other, you know,
out of the way,
off cliffs in order to get to you first, to put you on the air.
I'd like to watch that myself, actually. But, you know, let me just interject here one thing, okay? Because the fact, you know, the big kicker for these guys. They said they love most of what Trump's doing. Don't get us wrong. The tax thing, this and that. We love all of that. But foreign policy and trade deals, he's so crazy and can't be deal with and all that. And you mentioned the rumor of Mattis pulling a trade the deal with South Korea off his desk. Well, you know, not for nothing, this guy who's spent the last 50 years in business is probably more qualified than anybody that's ever sat in that White House to negotiate trade deals or any other kind of business deal. Most of these people have never negotiated business deals, and that's all he's ever done.
I'm not necessarily going to agree with that, because running a business and not running it very well, by all accounts of his finances.
I'm going to disagree with that. Having close knowledge in the real estate industry in New York, what looks like not running it well just because it filed bankruptcy doesn't mean that the shareholders didn't make a gazillion dollars ripping off the public or whatever. And if that's your job and you accomplish it, then you did it well. It's a different job than the qualifications for being president. But when you're sitting down negotiating contracts with people on the other side, you know, if he got people to build his hotels and didn't have to pay them, he might be a lousy human being. But the contract with the contractors were negotiated very well from his point of view.
Okay, well, a national trade agreements and a business contract to make money are not the same thing.
I understand. We'll
agree to disagree on that one. But I think we agree on that it was not Mattis's, anywhere within his purview or the purview of any politician, to swipe this off the president's deck in order to stop him from signing.
Well, I will say this much on that point, though, okay? If I'm going to send somebody in on my team to negotiate a trade deal, a real estate closing, or whatever, it's going to be Trump and not the general.
Okay, well, that much I'll agree with you, that it's not Mattis's, it's nowhere within his purview to make a decision on trade. At the end of the day, you either believe that the president has the right, any president has the right to make these decisions, or you stop believing in U.S. democracy.
Take your choice.
And this is again and again what you see. I mean, the other concrete example that this anonymous deep stater who outed himself says in this, the other thing he mentioned was relations with Russia, that Trump didn't want to kick out 60 diplomats in the wake of this totally absurd Skripal affair and allegations without what anyone would consider adequate evidence from the United Kingdom, and that we needed to respond to Russia. And quite specifically, Trump was elected. If there is one campaign position on foreign policy that he consistently had, it was to improve relations with Russia. He was elected to the presidency by a narrow margin, God knows. But he was elected, to improve, explicitly to improve relations with Russia. Why people voted for him or not is regardless. They knew that was his position.
It was an unpopular position that cost him votes for sure.
It didn't gain him any credits with the Republican Republican Party. Yep. I don't believe it gave him any bonus with the Republican base. Mm-hmm. I don't think they really, care about relations with Russia other than what their leader tells them they should believe on it. I'm of course not to the people listening to the show, even a few of them on the right or something. I'm talking in general. Right. Americans, by and large, do not vote on foreign policy. They vote on their policy. This is held up by countless surveys, polls, elections, everything that shows this. So it's not simply a Republican thing. But that is once again the deep state ensuring they know better that Russia should be our enemy. And they're going to make sure they stay that way. It's just wrong.
Yeah,
it's unconstitutional.
I want to quote it.
It amounts to a coup.
Yeah, I just want to quote it on that point. That this is like the big sin here. The president was reluctant to expel so many of those diplomats and complained for weeks about senior staff members getting him boxed into further confrontations with Russia. In other words, he complained that the staff was boxing him into confrontation with Russia when he was trying to deconstruct the confrontation regime that had been established.
Which I feel is the whole point of this whole Skripal nonsense right. to begin with. Right. Coming, I think the UK has long been wagging the Trump administration dog on Russia.
Yeah.
That is. And this isn't playing around. Right. This is continually putting us in situations of significant military tensions in multiple places with Russia that conceivably, not likely, but could. Conceivably, you know, with misunderstandings, mistakes being made, lead to military and even nuclear confrontation.
Well, let's look at one. I mean, because we mentioned at the head end of this, we've got, supposedly he's been boxed into making statements about an indefinite stay in Syria. Russia's saying, look, we're going in to clean out Idlib now. We know you got a few dozen guys in there. Get them out so they don't get hurt. And if the people who in the deep state who are insistent that the U.S. stay in there and that they take a hard line with the Assad regime and all of the nonsense you're going to hear on television, you know, a couple of U.S. soldiers get killed and Trump doesn't turn around and bomb, you know, how many steps is it to either telling him, look, we're going to kill you or remove you from office unless you respond the way we want, or just pulling him out of office? Now, if I'm Russia and I'm looking at a coup in the United States over this, and they're coming to talk to me about what I need to do next, they got to look at this as a really dangerous situation and maybe have to respond preemptively.
Yeah. I think that segues us right into, a larger discussion of Trump administration in Syria right. and events in Idlib and elsewhere. The Washington Post, as of this morning, Friday morning, sorry, comes out with a piece by Karen DeYoung, one of their typical national security reporters that takes their stenography from the intelligence and the military quite seriously. Evidently, the Trump administration has suddenly reversed course on everything they said about getting out of Syria, and now Trump has agreed to an indefinite military effort in Syria, meaning that they have no intention of leaving.
Right. Yeah.
And they specifically say our new policy is not only about ISIS, the final defeat of ISIS, and it has to be said, the only significant presence of ISIS left in Syria is in areas completely surrounded by U.S. territory up against the Iraqi border, and it has been reported by the UN that the U.S. is giving them breath, right. is giving them time. There have been no significant military actions against ISIS in the United States since last November, since November 2017. So it is obvious that that the U.S. is either simply allowing them to exist in one or two small pockets, simply to justify their continued illegal invasion and occupation of Syria. Or in some cases, they may actually be managing them and right. using them for attacks right. through zones they ostensibly control on Syrian government-held territory.
Right, right.
And none of this actually comes from Trump himself. Interesting,
right. Which is it's also important. That's an important point because. You keep in mind, there's the virtual show. You've got Nikki Haley at the UN. You've got Pompeo. All these different and Mattis. All these people talk all these different things. And so far, every time it's been push coming to shove, they're reversed by the president. And the policy that comes out of his mouth is the one that gets followed.
I would actually say it's the other way around. That whatever comes out of his mouth is quickly overruled. whether the documents are swiped off his desk or otherwise.
I'm looking at Korea and you know, the U.S. hasn't really, you know, well, go ahead, make your point, because
this is coming from James Jeffrey, who has been appointed the special envoy to the situation in Syria now, new Syrian czar.
He's Pompeo's boy there, right?
Boy, yeah. And he specifically says that, you know, that we're there not just for ISIS, but we're there to drive Iran out of Syria, as if the U.S. has the right to say who the Syrian government allies with and allows on their territory. Right. And they once again bring up this, we're there until we see basically a government that we like take power in Damascus. Meaning, once again, even though they deny it in other words, you know, back to a regime change. He says specifically, U.S. policy is not that Assad must go. Assad has no future, but it's not our job to get rid of him. But we're not going to leave until we see a government that is acceptable to the, quote, international community, unquote.
Right. It's,
So, you know, this is, you got to wonder what Russia, you know, and Iran and China and other countries, you know, that are very involved here. Even Turkey and Saudi Arabia have got to be suffering from whiplash at this point.
And Turkey, especially, you know, they're Turkey's a very complex player in this all of a sudden, you know.
Yeah, it's multiple, you know, complex players all the way around. Sure. So that, I think, brings us, well, first, Russia has also threatened now, evidently, at least according to several accounts in Business Insider and several other publications, that Russia has threatened the United States in the Al-Tanf base. Now, the U.S. and its proxy forces, the Syrian Democratic Forces, control all of essentially East Syria, everything east of the Euphrates. But they also control one more pocket of significant size in South Syria, right along the Jordanian border, in Syria, in a former Syrian base called Al-Tanf. And at Al-Tanf, the U.S. And Jordan were training fighters and shipping them across the border there. They kind of slowed down operations there. There were at least three times, that the U.S. attacked and killed Syrian government forces that it said came too close. They've got a security perimeter they've proclaimed around this occupied area of South Syria, and they have attacked Syrian government forces approaching anywhere near this area at least three times already. Just this week, you know, we saw last week this piece by David Ignatius in the Washington Post, where he talked to another anonymous Trump administration official that said the goal of the U.S. was now to create as many quagmires in Syria for Russia and the Syrian government as it could until we get what we want. Well, one of those examples came up clearly in the last week. Russia caught a number of fighters, jihadis, the Lions of the Desert. These are fighters that were formerly evidently affiliated with ISIS. They're now under the U.S. aegis. They were beginning to carry out bombings, attacks in the Palmyra area. That is, you know, kind of like behind lines already, because Palmyra has long been in the area of Syrian government control. They were caught and, you know, they squealed and they said, we were trained and armed by the Americans at Al-Tanf, where they're preparing a larger force there. The Russian government put this out. It was reported all over Russian media and the alternative media. Of course, it didn't make it to the mainstream media at all. They didn't report it. And this week, we've got the word now, supposedly coming from the U.S., that Russia has warned them that if they, you know, that there are militants in Al-Taf and they will not allow it to be used as a base for jihadist attacks against them, and that they're threatening to attack the base. Man. And the U.S. replies back that we will defend ourselves if attacked.
Yep. Yep.
So this is one of these flashpoints right here. Here, you know, we see the U.S. is training up terrorists for terror, you know, for literal, you know, bombings and stuff behind lines. And Russia is saying that, you know, we can't allow this to happen. You know, this is not even, you know, the quasi legitimacy of a proxy Kurdish government in East Syria. You know, this is just straight up terrorism, you know, using jihadis, and we can't allow it. And the you know, these are fighting words being echoed here. Now, I expect the Russian government to back down, at least for the time being here. They've got far right. more important things going on in Idlib, and Idlib is right now the fate of Idlib. I mean, I believe that it's probably already been written, but we've got this Astana framework meeting going on that right as we speak with Putin, Rouhani, the Iranian president, and Erdogan, the Turkish regime leader, in Tehran right now. And ostensibly, this is, you know, the three countries that are really deciding what is going on right. in Syria right now. And this is Russia and Iran representing, you know, the forces allied with the Syrian government. And across the table is Turkey, right. who continues to be the patron and speak for the rebels, you know, the various right. jihadis and Islamists, you know, that are forces that are left in the country. And of course, the area of Turkish occupation adjacent to Idlib.
We're going to have to stop here because we're out of time, but I'd like to pick it up here next week because obviously Turkey has its own security concerns. And Turkey also has been one of the protagonists in the attack on Syria in the first place, and we have to work that some to give people some more context.
I expect the Astana framework to fall apart and yep. the Russian and Syrian government to attack Idlib before we talk again.
Okay, Mark, thank you very much. I'll speak with you again next week. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. U.S. President Donald Trump has done a complete reversal on Syria, a full 180. What accounts for this, why, and what's next? Crosstalking Trump's 180 on Syria, I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And we have Glenn Deason. He is a visiting scholar at the Higher School of Economics. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. We're going to devote this entire program to what's going on in Syria, primarily Donald Trump's 180. A few months ago, he mentioned publicly of getting out of Syria. Now, it looks like the president has changed his mind or has had his mind changed. Mark.
Yeah, I think I'll go with the last. After what we've seen this week with the release of the book by Bob Woodward, with the release of this anonymous editorial in the New York Times, this is op-ed in the New York Times, I'm sorry, with this deep stater in the administration outing himself. I'm sorry, not deep stater.
He prefers, steady stater.
He prefers the term steady state. All right. Okay, steady stater. You know, saying that he swipes documents off of Donald Trump's desk to prevent him from signing them, and that there's a cabal of officials, particularly on foreign policy, that do whatever they can to prevent Donald Trump's policies from being fulfilled. So I think we're looking rather at the deep state, the steady state, has full control of the foreign and military policy now with regards to Syria, as we've long discussed about. And we heard this announcement of this new policy of this indefinite, forever U.S. military presence in Syria, not by Trump himself, but by James Jeffrey.
Okay, what is the strategy, Glenn? Do they even know at this point?
No, I think it's a good question to ask whether or not there's a clear strategy. Definitely after Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, it's worth asking whether or not there's a clear strategy behind. But I think with Trump, it's definitely something to this that the U.S. isn't actually acting as a unitary actor at the moment, given that you have this infighting even within its own administration. But if we assume that Trump's assumptions have been quite genuine, that he wants to pull America's security guarantees back a little bit, there has been two important exceptions, which has been first Iran. He's quite hostile in Iran. And the second would be America's friendship with Israel. And of course, Syria is right in the middle of both these two exceptions. So I guess he was always somewhat predisposed to switching.
The interesting thing is that if he takes out his parenthetical envelope with all of his promises on the back that I've mentioned many times in this program, he's not technically starting a new war. That was his promise, okay? So he's fibbing it here. Dima, we had Iran, Russia, and Turkey meeting in Tehran. Everyone puts a nice face on it, but it was a disaster. It was a car wreck.
Well, I think
why?
The very fact that Turkey, Russia, and Iran worked on something together for the first time in, I think, three centuries, you know, if you look at the history of conflict, we never could, agree on something in common.
But who's the odd man out?
I think in this time, it's, of course, President Erdogan.
This time?
Keep going. But it's very unfortunate because basically, when I talk to Syrians, they all agree that the war is over. The war should be over because...
It should be, but it looks like it's going to be reignited in a really big way.
The problem is that the opposition has exhausted its potential. I mean, it's clear that Syrians want peace. The country is exhausted. Everything is more or less clear, you know. And the Syrians, they simply have no guts, no desire for a continued war. So they're really irritated by this continued uncertainty about Idlib.
That's exactly where we wanted to go. You're absolutely right, but they're not so exhausted that they're not going to, and they are doing it as we speak right now, liberating the city.
What we've actually seen so far is just the claiming of the low-hanging fruit. The real wars are yet to come, and they could potentially be much, much more significant. With regards to the strategy that the U.S. is deploying in Syria, I think the Moon of Alabama blog
eloquently. Here it is. We're all on this, literally on the same page here.
U.S. military illegally stays and occupies East Syria. Underpants. Iran leaves Syria, and the Syrian government falls. I mean, that's the U.S. strategy.
Yeah, but in reading the same article here, Glenn, it was that everyone has to, all foreigners have to leave Syria except for the United States. Mm. So,
go ahead, the Turks.
Yeah, okay. Well, that remains to be played out here. But there seems to be a move to create, in effect, a partition. Right now, I mean, the U.S. wants to create some kind of stateless, semi-autonomous, semi-independent that will be dependent on the Western powers, primarily the United States. No one in the region wants that, bar maybe Israel.
Saudi Arabia as well. Yeah, well, I think that, we're going to have to appreciate the situation that the United States isn't at the moment in terms of what their initial objectives were. Because, of course, when they went into Syria first supporting this we want to call it. But of course, the objectives were somewhat clear. You get rid of Assad, which is an important ally of Iran. They're considered annoyance to Israel. And of course, you reestablish U.S. hegemony in the region.
But the people of Syria thought differently, apparently.
Apparently they did. And But I'm just saying now we have the opposite. Iran has more influence there than it had in the past. The U.S. has been largely discredited in the region. And, of course, Russia's back as a security provider. So, you know, either if you're from Egypt or Jordan, if you, you know, want security in the region from now on, you have to also book a flight to Moscow. So I think that everything they went for has gone the other way. And that's not necessarily a good thing, because when you have this winner-takes-all situations, the other side, more historically, they've been more willing to do more high-risk moves.
That explains David Ignatius's interview with a high White House official about creating quagmires in Syria. Dima, usually the term strategic patience is applied to the United States in dealing with North Korea. But the Russians have been strategically patient in Syria. You could tell in Tehran that Vladimir Putin is beginning to lose his patience with his partners and with the situation on the ground.
Again, Syrians are losing their patience with the war. And, of course, Russians, including Vladimir Putin, are losing their patience with the so-called international community. I mean, I watched this UN session chaired by Victoria Nuland on Syria. And I was just disgusted, you know.
Give me a reason why. Give me an example.
The French said that Russia's was the main responsibility for the possible humanitarian catastrophe. France bombed Syria. France was never invited there. It is a former colonial power. The French killed hundreds of thousands of Syrians in the 20th century. And now they say this is all our responsibility. There was Victoria Nuland herself, who just recently said Russia was never going to be America's friend. You remember? And now she's calling on Russia in the end of her speech. We are calling on Russia, walk with us. Walk with the UN. You're never going to be our friend, but walk with us.
Let me decode that. It means listen to us and do what we say here. Mark, exactly.
Very quick. The United States has been warned about bad consequences in Syria. Nouri al-Maliki, the former prime minister of Iraq, said that the civil war would spread to Iraq. They said no, and it did spread. The African Union, about Libya, the African Union warned the United States that after Gaddafi falls, there is going to be a migration disaster, it's going to be a chaos.
Before 2003, there was no ISIS in Iraq, and there was no ISIS in Syria.
True.
Mark, we hear humanitarian catastrophe. But we've heard this many, many times before. Look what happened with Aleppo. When it was liberated, was there a humanitarian catastrophe? No, but it was completely forgotten. Okay,
well, sure, the
same thing.
The humanitarian forces of Al-Qaeda were completely driven from the city. I mean, this coming from the United States is simply risible. All right. No one cried about a humanitarian catastrophe when the U.S. was bombing the Iraqi cities of Fallujah, of Mosul, or uninvited the Syrian cities of Raqqa, Kobani, Manbij, when they were driving jihadists, in this case ISIS, out of western Iraq and eastern Syria. In fact, an interagency UN team and Amnesty International on the ground in Raqqa after the U.S. offensive said it was the most destroyed city in the Syrian conflict. 70-80% of the buildings destroyed, far more than 2,000 civilian casualties. This is, you know, the rhetoric that we hear from the United States. Basically, it's saying when you are conducting counter-terror ops against Al-Qaeda and the remnants of our proxies, do what we say, not what we did in Syria.
You know, interesting, Glenn, it's interesting how Trump is being played into this here, because I think there's a lot of smart military people would think that the military strategy there, it isn't a military strategy at this point, it's a political one. It's creating a putting down a marker here. There could be a conflict with Russia in all this. Has this been thought out, or is it a bluff?
Well, I think they can definitely stumble into this. Again, when you develop a strategy, what distinguishes strategy from policy is usually you have to predict what the adversaries will do. And then I think in this situation, they've had too many actors with too many interests, and they might not have planned everything out. We often assume that They know exactly what they're doing, but I don't think that they do. And I think this quagmire strategy is part of the
reason. We're going to go to a quick break here, but one of the things that's happened here is usually somebody must go, then you invade the country. But now they've invaded the country, and then they're deciding what should be done. So this is regime change and reverse. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Syria. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go to markets. Kind of broaden this out. I'd like to kind of look at the interests and positions of some of the characters in this beyond Donald Trump. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think probably the most important from the very beginning has always been Turkey and Erdogan. I mean, without the Turkish border, none of the U.S., Saudi, Qatari supplies, jihadi shipped around the world would get into Syria. And their role in that as the base, I mean, the U.S. bases in Turkey for illegally arming, training, and salarying their jihadi proxies for regime change in Syria were literally euphemistically named the mom's centers. And these were Erdogan's mom centers in Turkey. In the Astana Agreement, this has always been kind of a geopolitical dance, if you will. Imagine Putin and Erdogan waltzing across a chessboard with daggers poised at each other's back. They both have interests. Russia was trying to exploit the split of the disagreements between Erdogan and the U.S. and NATO, especially over the Kurds and so on, and paying lip service to Turkish interests in there. But what he was really trying to do is cut the other backers of regime change, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, the US, UK, France, Israel, out of it, right? Because if he could deal with Turkey, he knew that supply lines, the open border, it was always about Turkey. In this latest Astana summit in Tehran, we saw the gloves come off and we saw the reality that it's been all along.
One of the things, Glenn, I mean, it seems to me that Turkey is ending up isolating itself. It has kind of a tepid, cool relationship with the U.S. Look what happened to the Turkish lira, the situation with NATO. Obviously, Iran and Russia are at odds with Erdogan's plans. He doesn't want to see Idlib fall. He's the odd guy out here, and it's probably not a good position to be in for very long.
No, I agree, and I think that he's alienated everyone now, from the Europeans to Americans, Russia, of course Syria as well as the Iranians don't trust him fully. But I think that, improvement of relations between Russia and Turkey is, as Mark pointed out, can be a bit deceptive. I think that this rift between the Americans and the Turks definitely have given Russia some flexibility, but at the end of the day, as we saw now in this meeting, their interests are quite different.
Yeah, well, Russia and Turkey have mutual interests, okay? Yeah. I don't call them partners.
Not in Syria.
Okay, not in Syria. Okay.
No, I think actually that's the irony of the whole thing. Like, Syria is where their interests would clash the most. In other areas, their interests are much more aligned. So I think that the split with the U.S. and also other interests in terms of Turkey considering leaning more to the east, I think weapon sales, I think there's a lot of areas they can work in. And I think that Erdogan perhaps was trying to use this.
The real wrinkle in all of this, Dima, is the Kurds, okay, because the U.S. continues to support them. But people on the ground do not want in northern Syria, in northeast Syria, they don't want to be ruled by Turkey's, what would you call them? Their assets, okay. And then at the same time, they don't want to be ruled by these Arab tribes. Don't want to be ruled by the Kurds. So I mean, it's kind of a hopeless situation there. And then the U.S. is in the middle of it all.
Well, when the U.S. moved in and when they destabilized the situation in Syria, like they destabilized the situation in Iraq before, consequences were unpredictable. It's like starting a chain reaction, and I'm not even sure the United States is really guided by interests in this whole situation, because if we look at the results are abysmal for U.S. interests. The United States failed to topple not even an anti-Western. President Assad was not anti-Western. A mildly disagreeing
regime.
Well,
he was called a reformer.
Absolutely, yes. And the result is that they basically lost a very important ally, Turkey, which is much more important than Syria. In Libya, they moved in. Okay, they didn't like Gaddafi. Gaddafi was killed. Now they have a civil war in Libya, migration crisis in Europe. ISIS operating in Libya. So if we judge the situation from the position of interests, Obama should be declared the most disastrous president in U.S. history, you know, simply because his actions were against the long-term U.S. interests.
Well, so, Mark, is this just refusing defeat? I mean, is this double down and keep trying what we've been doing before? I mean, explain the rationality. Is it just the empire? Is it messianic? I mean, Dima's right. I mean, if it's interest, then where are the results? I mean, the results side of the ledger is pretty thin.
Yeah, I mean, they, of course, refuse to see that, you know, the increased Iranian-Russian influence is obvious blowback to what we all saw at the beginning of the conflict. They have an inability to see that. And they also have an inability to admit defeat to Russia. That would have huge geopolitical repercussions around the world. Right? They simply can't allow it. So what the neocons have been doing is all along, since Trump took office, they've been planning to use this Iran spin to convince Trump to become more active in Syria, not because of Russia, but because of Iran. And that has played out in what the U.S. has announced as their new strategy, i.e. they are never leaving their illegal military occupation of Syria unless Iran leaves all their troops home, which is a matter between Syria and Iran. And the Syrian government that is acceptable to the international
community.
They said, we're not interested in regime change, but we're not leaving until we get a government that is acceptable to the international community.
Which means the Washington consensus here. Yeah. Glenn, we've talked about this subject so many times on this program here, but really the issue, we have players like Turkey that are unpredictable, but one country that is absolutely predictable in all this is Iran. And Iran has made it very, very clear that will not allow the current government, the current political arrangement in Damascus to be forcefully overthrown. That is their red line. And that's what the U.S. cannot accept.
No, I agree with that. And it would also be reasonable to suspect that they might be next in line once they're cut off from Syria. So I think it's just healthy self-defense as well, in addition to looking after an ally. But I think their interests are clear because, they're clearly defined and they've been following it throughout the whole thing.
And they're invited. They're wanted there.
Yes, which is why it's slightly ironic that the Americans will set up an occupation zone now in Syria are calling for the Iranians to pull back, which obviously Iran didn't appreciate, as they're actually invited to stabilize the country.
If there's going to be a permanent presence here, then it tells me that we will never get to a period of peace. I mean, this goes back to the Quagmire comment, which I think it was probably Bolton or Pompeo that said that. Is that because they don't have an end game that they can achieve, just keep stirring it up. I mean, I've kind of likened it to like a roulette wheel. You know, you throw the wheel, it starts spinning, and then you throw the ball on. You don't get the number you want. Let's spin it again. That seems to me the strategy here, which is very dangerous.
Well, I agree. I think the quagmire, as well as setting up the occupation zone, is more indication of an absence of a strategy, because what they're saying is essentially hold the position. We're not sure what we want yet or how we can get it, but we'll delay and see what opportunities comes in the future, and we can negotiate with this quagmire.
Hey, so that's expensive. It creates tensions. And
bleed Russia and Iran, just like we did in Afghanistan by supporting the Mujahideen.
Point.
Well, I mean, you compare it to roulette. I compare it to history. I like historical comparisons.
I know,
Mark.
This will be your first time, huh?
but I compare it to the idea of world revolution that the early Bolshevist state spread.
No,
the whole idea.
So this is not historical. This is ideology.
Absolutely. I mean, like, we tried in Hungary. We failed. Doesn't matter. We'll try again. We'll try again in Germany. In Germany, we failed.
Okay. You're talking about the immediate period after the First World War.
After the First World War, when Russia was really ideological, when Bolshevism was really in its early stage, very active and believing in itself. So in the same way, it all reminds me of this. Okay, we failed in Iraq. You know, Iraq is allowing now Iranian missiles.
It is reported.
Next to the Israeli territory. Doesn't matter. We'll try again in Libya. We failed in Libya? Doesn't matter. The ideology cannot be wrong. You know, people can be wrong. Individuals can be wrong. We picked up a wrong candidate, Hillary Clinton. She was too divisive. We'll have a better one next time. But we couldn't fail. We couldn't be wrong.
Because the ideology is correct.
The ideology is correct. So in the same way, the approach in Syria now, this document, United Nations Directive on... Let me quote it, parameters and principles of UN aid to Syria. The idea of that document is that there should be no UN aid to reconstruct Syria until there is a political transition.
Or maybe to this little statelet, they will get aid here. You know, Mark, one of the things I find fascinating, going back to the internal politics of the United States, is that this is throwing the dice. But if it fails, well, it's Trump's fault, isn't it? It's his administration.
Well, I mean, we could completely ignore that it was Obama who actually launched the proxy war on Syria, if we want. But I don't really see it that way, because we see broad bipartisan support. Whether it's Adam Schiff Nancy Pelosi doing meet and greets with the Mujahideeni calc, you know, video messages and so on. There is broad bipartisan support. The two-party war party.
The McCain consensus.
The McCain consensus is fully behind, the U.S. Stepping up their aggression against Syria, not stepping it down.
Success.
If he stepped it down, they would blame him for that.
Success, yeah, but success has many fathers, but failure... Mm-hmm. Is a bastard, okay? And I think this
bastard.
Is no. There's a bipartisan support at the highest levels against President Trump. They want to see him fail on everything, okay? Even if it's in spite of the interests of the United States and the world. Here, I'm going to give you the last word, Glenn. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with what Mark said in terms of this, a bipartisan interest in this, in continuing this, what is essentially a failed mission. But at the same time, I would point out that a lot of people in Washington are noticing that this, the unipolar moment is retracting, and there is a vacuum opening being filled with rival powers.
Does that make the U.S. more aggressive in its allies?
Yeah, but even though it recognizes it, there's no one who really have a good answer, well, what now? What do you transition to next? Because, yes, like they pointed out, they would like to work with Russia as long as Russia does what it's told. So it's not really quite sure what will come next. And I think
they should transition to building a wall on the southern border. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.